Okay, so the mitzvah we're up to now is number 88. If you remember, last week's mitzvah was mitzvah of Shemitah. And at first blush, this won't necessarily appear as a continuation of Shemitah, but you'll see that it does have a link and a connection in that regard. So we'll look at the Sefer Chinuch first, and then we will talk more about it. So that's the first source. Mitzvah number 88, mitzvah chagiga beragalayim, meaning the mitzvah of your regals. So the mitzvah of your regals, regalim, are the shalosh regalim of Pesach and Shavuot and Sukkot. And you have a mitzvah to celebrate these three chagim, as we all know. Now, what is the actual mitzvah of these chagim? Now, each one has many of its own mitzvot, but there's sort of a meta mitzvah. There's a mitzvah above all of them that apply to all three of them. And that's the chagigah. That's the celebration of all three of them. Now, the text, if you look in the English, it suggests that there are two major components. The commandment of celebration of the festivals, to celebrate on the festivals, that which we've commanded, to come up for the festival to the temple three times a year. And there, when we are there, you shall celebrate for me in this year. And the matter of celebration is that we should go up there with a sacrifice, and we slaughter it as a peace offering, shlamim, and in honor of the festival. So you see two elements, I think, of this mitzvah. The first element is the mitzvah of going up to Jerusalem. And the second element is the actual karban, the sacrifice itself. So we could really talk about either of those two things. We could either talk about Yerushalayim, or we could talk about the whole concept of karbanot and sacrifices. What I thought I would do now is sort of continue with what we were talking about with Shemitah. With Shemitah, we spoke about how it's an opportunity for people to take a break from what they're normally doing, to turn to sort of more spiritual matters, more educational matters, come up to Yerushalayim and learn. And so I thought I'd focus on the Yerushalayim aspect of the mitzvah. But at the very end, remind me if I forget, I'll actually try to make the argument that the two elements, the karbanot, the sacrifice element, and Yerushalayim, are actually almost one and the same. So what I thought we'd do is mostly talk about why is Yerushalayim special. If you remember from Shemitah, and when we spoke a little bit about Maser Sheni and Bikurim, all these agricultural mitzvot, the idea was we have to get people up to Yerushalayim as much as possible. Just the experience of being here, of meeting with the Kohanim and the Levi'im, and the people who live in Yerushalayim have decided to make it their home, very often are more connected to spirituality, will rub off on, if you remember last week, we spoke about some of these farmers who were not at all the elite, but if they spend time here in Yerushalayim, they'll be impacted by the experience. And by the way, you see it even today. You know, there's a number of these different organizations that make Yerushalayim a central part of their trips to Israel. And many of these organizations, by the way, I'm thinking, for example, of Birthright. I'm sure you've all heard of Birthright. You know, it brings college students to Israel. The founders of Birthright are not interested in Aliyah. They're not interested in making people Zionists even, which is interesting. You know, they're bringing to Israel. You would think it has something to do with Zionism. It doesn't. Their stated purpose, actually, is to, they're not anti-Zionist, God forbid, but their stated purpose is to actually increase their Jewish identity back home. But the most powerful way of doing it, they felt that they couldn't actually inspire people back home. The most powerful way of doing it is giving them a Yerushalayim experience. Coming here has a ripple effect back when they go home. And that's one of the things that we will see. No, no, 10 days. 10 days. It's just a sort of a jolt in the arm. Now, there's so many things we could say about Yerushalayim and what's special about it and what inspires people. Some of my favorite halachot, for example, I don't know if you've ever seen this one halacha that says you're not supposed to actually go see your accountant in Yerushalayim. They would have a place where all the accountants would be right outside of the city. And the reason why is that you always have to be in a state of simcha, of joy, in Yerushalayim. And so therefore, if you go to your accountant and you get bad news, it's going to ruin that state. So the Mishnah prefers that you should have your accountants outside of the city in case there's bad news. Similarly, with this concept of simcha, you know, for example, everywhere outside of Yerushalayim, if God forbid you're at a shiva house, Kohanim don't duchen. right? The Kohanim don't get up. It's not something that you do. In fact, Kohanim actually don't duchen outside of Eretz Yisrael except on the Chagim itself. And the principle is that a Kohen has to be in a state of simcha in order to duchen. And we say when you're outside of the land of Israel, you don't have that state of simcha except on the Chagim. And in Israel, you do have that state. But obviously, during a Shiva, you wouldn't have that state of simcha. The one exception is in Yerushalayim. The minhag in Yerushalayim is you always, just by being here, have a state of simcha, an attitude of joy, that it overcomes even on some level the prohibition of the Shiva. So there's many more we can go. I actually started to just look at some of the different minhagim we have that have to do with funerals or weddings. We know that weddings were constantly reminded of Yerushalayim and in benching. And wherever you go, there's always something to remind you of Yerushalayim. So I kind of felt like it was almost like too much of a sea. You know, it was a sea of possibilities of where to go. So I chose one baraita that establishes 10 principles or 10 customs or laws of Yerushalayim as a framework in which perhaps we can understand more about Yerushalayim in general. So if you look at the second source, Bava Kama, page 82, that's Pei Bet, Amud Bet. And the Baraita says as follows, in the Gemara is quoting, Asara Dvarim Ne'amru B'Yerushalayim. There are 10 things that were stated about Yerushalayim. Ein Habayit Chalut, I'll translate that in just a moment. The Eno Mevia Agala Rufa. So there are certain things that you can't do in Yerushalayim that otherwise the general law is that you would do. Like I mentioned with the regards to Duchening. So what's a Chalut Ba? So the case is, in general, when you're selling your property, sometimes you sell your property because you don't have the, you don't want to sell it, but you have to sell it for whatever reason. So there is a general halakha that the person who sells their property has an opportunity within a year to buy it back, okay? So if he comes and gets all their money, they can go and buy it back. That principle doesn't exist in Yerushalayim, okay? It doesn't exist and we'll see why in a moment. The Egela Rufa case, you're familiar with it, is you take the cow, that if there is a person who was found murdered outside the city boundaries, and you don't know which city is responsible, you don't know who, you have this whole ceremony where you take a cow that's never worked, you go to a riverbed that's, you know, dried up, and you kill the animal, and the sages wash their hands and say, we have nothing to do with it. Anyway, you don't do that ceremony in Yerushalayim. You don't make Yerushalayim ever an ir nidachat. An ir nidachat is a city which everyone has been accused of being idol worshippers, so much so that you would have to destroy the entire city. So you would never do that with Yerushalayim. No, that's an ir miklat. Yeah, but we're going to look at the concept of the ari miklat, the cities of refuge, right? If you are an accidental murderer, the gol adam, meaning the Goldam, the relative, may want to come and kill you if you, let's say, killed someone on the road. And so you run to the city and you're safe if you get there before the blood avenger reaches you first. So that's a different idea. That's what the Levite cities. There are 6 Levite cities, 3 on this side of the Yarden, Jordan River, and 3 on the other side. But we're going to talk about it because Yerushalayim, on some level, is modeled after the Levite city. Anyway, I'm going to just jump down to the English so we can go a little faster. You see, it says, the Gemara cites a Braita that contains a list of halachot unique to Jerusalem. 10 matters were stated. A house situated in Jerusalem does not become irredeemable 1 year after its sale, right? That's what the chalutba, right? You're allowed to buy it even 2 years or 3 years. The elders do not bring a heifer whose neck is broken with regard to the murder victim. That's the Egla Rufa. And you see the sources there as well. It cannot become an idolatrous city. That would be destroyed. The Braita continues with its list. A house in Jerusalem cannot become ritually impure with the impurity of leprous sores, like leprosy. You're right. Most, when we moved into Eretz Yisrael, houses sometimes had the negaim, the signs that there was leprosy involved. That didn't take place in Yerushalayim. This is an interesting one, which obviously we don't practice today. One cannot build out projections or balconies from houses that are in it, right? If you, now there, it's 2 things. One is, it's not the problem of having a balcony. promise of having a balcony that protrudes outside of the house. If you go to Meir Shearim today, you'll see, especially during Sukkot time, right? You'll see they build temporary structures to put the balconies out into the middle of the street. That's not permissible, according to the Gemara and Bava Kamma. You cannot have garbage dumps in Yerushalayim. You're not allowed to have the garbage dumps. You can't build kilns, things that will create smoke and the like. You can't plant gardens and orchards in Yerushalayim, except for rose gardens that were already in existence from the time of the early prophets. You can't raise chickens in Yerushalayim. And finally, you may not leave a corpse overnight in Yerushalayim. Okay, so those are the different things about Yerushalayim. Now, what are all these prohibitions? Why are we not allowed to have chickens or gardens? Gardens sounds like quite a beautiful thing. Exactly. So I'm going to save you. Don't worry. Okay. And if you have a balcony, also we'll take care of you. So it's okay. I don't want anyone to have to tear down parts of their house as a result of this shear. Yes. Right, but so it's an additional principle is we bury right away, right? So in Yerushalayim, in general, you're absolutely right. You shouldn't leave any. The Rambam, by the way, expands on this, which is an interesting idea because we actually have something the opposite of the way it's practiced today. The Rambam says you're not allowed to leave dead bodies, as always, as all throughout Eretz Yisrael, but we do funerals at night here. Don't even leave them overnight, right? Because of the Kedusha, considered it's not Kodesh if you have a dead body. Also, you're not supposed to bring dead bodies into Yerushalayim, which is interesting because the custom has developed, of course, is that many people from overseas choose to be buried in Yerushalayim. The Rambam says that we really shouldn't have that custom to be buried in Yerushalayim, bringing in more death or tumah to the city. It actually should not have this principle. There's something to it. And, you know, my wife always says that when she comes up to Yerushalayim and the first thing you see is Har Menuchot, it on one hand, throws you off, right, the cemetery, and it's getting bigger and bigger, and, okay. Yeah, now, yeah, they're getting more, and now they're doing a city. They call it this underground city. They're putting underground as well. With underground burials, or yeah, well, there's a lot of, listen, in general, we know that cemeteries are actually supposed to be outside the city. This was outside the city. The city has grown up. And there are considerations of how you can have burials that what they try to do is cover them by creating enough earth in between, but there's certainly not necessarily the ideal way of doing this. But they're struggling because the city has grown tremendously. They're trying to figure out solutions for that. What are the different reasons for all these different things? So I'd like to say there's about three or four different ideas. The Gemara continues, and I want to focus on maybe two of the ideas at the end, but I'll just give you some of them. Let's see if I brought them here. Okay, in the Hebrew, I didn't do the translation of the second paragraph of the Hebrew. All that English is the translation of the first paragraph in the Hebrew. The Hebrew gives us the reasons, the Gemara continues, of why all these different things. So I'm not going to read the first couple of things, but I'll point out a couple of reasons. One of them certainly has to do with what we were talking about, Ole Lerego. People who are coming up, right? All these people, the Book of Our Heritage, I think is the English translation, Sefer HaTeudah, he describes what it was like on a Pesach. He says all the mountains around Yerushalayim looked like they were full of snow. What does that mean, full with snow? They had so many white sheep of people bringing up their sheep, their animals for the sacrifices, that it was covered in white, meaning the city grew tremendously in population because all of Israel was coming into the city. So one of the big elements of Yerushalayim is that it is a city of pilgrims. It's meant to be a place where it's easy for people to come in as much as possible, especially on those Shalosh Regalim. In fact, we said one of the big parts of all these mitzvot we've been talking about is that it's so that people can be connected to the city. So that's one of the things. So for example, with regards to the not building the balconies, The reason that the Gemara gives is that when you build balconies, you're building them into the public way. Think about the old city, and if someone built that, and he says, people are not familiar with all the, you know, if you're a visitor for the first time, you don't know all the different roads, and they were afraid that people would hit their heads on these balconies, or they would get lost because all of a sudden was once a horizon is now closed because of the balconies, and so you were not allowed to build balconies because it made it more difficult for the Olel Regel, the people who were coming up from Yerushalayim. So that's one of the things that is one of the reasons for some of these things. The other reason has to do with Kedusha, right? Remember, all these Olim who are coming up are purifying themselves because they're going to be involved in the temple service. And so they have to be in a state of purity, and they have to make sure that there is very little things that potentially could cause them to become Tamei. So again, with the balconies, if a balcony protrudes over a certain area, and if all of a sudden there is a dead body, right, under it, so that means everyone who walks under the balcony now becomes Tamei. So that also becomes a problem. And there's a lot of the other, why you're not allowed to have chickens, for example. The chickens, the fear was that they would go into the dumps and they'd peck around and they would find some of the meats that were used in the karbanot, whatever, and they would spread it around and that would also spread tumah. And so there's all these different examples. If you had dumps, the feeling was that if you had a lot of garbage dumps, it would attract insects and other things that also perhaps could create a problem of tuma.
Like what we now have.
Exactly. It doesn't mention anything about cats in here, though, you know, attracting all the different cats, but the... yeah. Well, that's thanks to the British. The British wanted to get rid of... There were a lot of mice in the turn of the century, and the British thought a good idea would to bring in a lot of cats, and it worked. There are actually very few mice compared to other cities in Yerushalayim than other places. The cost of that is we have a lot of cats. My fear, of course, is that someone's going to get the idea that it's going to become like Chad Gadya. Someone's going to import dogs to get rid of the cats, and then someone's going to bring it, and it's going to be an ongoing cycle in Yerushalayim. I always have that. I have that nightmare that it's going to keep going. So Kedusha is another one of the reasons given here. Then there are two additional reasons that are offered for a lot of the different things we've been talking about. The first reason seems to be connected to the concept of beauty, that Yerushalayim is supposed to be a beautiful place, free of pollution, free of smells. So, for example, you would think, well, why can't I have a garden then? Garden adds to the beauty. So in those days, how did they make gardens attractive? They fertilized it. So you'd walk into the city and you'd smell it incredibly powerfully strong. And so the fear was that you can't, it's not that you can't have a garden, the opposite. If you could create gardens that without the smell, then certainly you could have it. But again, you want these people visiting, not for them to remember the stench. So that was one of the concerns. And there's a few others that speak about the beauty of everything. So for example, again, you weren't supposed to have the kilns, the fires, because there would be smoke. You don't want people coming to Yerushalayim, and there would be like this pollution that it's hard to breathe in. And that's why you also didn't have the gardens, because you didn't want them to have this smell. The one answer they don't give is why, it doesn't give a reason of why you're not allowed to leave dead bodies overnight. We could say that it's obvious. I'm going to give another answer at the very end why that may be. It could be, but one night I don't think is really the issue so much. That's actually a very nice idea. It could be, and it could fit with what we had spoken at the very beginning about the joy. Mitzvot brings joy, and if you're not allowed to, that actually could be one of the ideas. So certainly part of it is beauty, that Yerushalayim should feel like a beautiful city. And I just want to talk about that for a little bit, and then I'm going to give you one other reason that the Gemara gives for a lot of these mitzvot. So in terms of beauty, you mentioned earlier the Ari Miklat, the cities of refuge. These are the Levite cities, right, that people would run to, but also they were the cities of Israel. They were, in a sense, the model from which other cities were to draw inspiration from. These were, in a sense, mini Yerushalayims, right, because they had were filled with Levites. The Gemara speaks about they had to be just the right size. They had to have, you know, enough business so that people could, you know, buy whatever they needed to buy, but it shouldn't be overly commercialized. There should be certain green spaces, certain parks, not certain industries. They were supposed to be idealized cities, and the Sefer HaChinuch elsewhere, mitzvah number 342, there is a mitzvah that you're not allowed to change the nature of the Levite cities. The Levite cities have a structure that the Torah actually speaks about, the structure of how many amot of green space, how much amot of commercial space, how many people can live, things along those lines. And you're not allowed to change that. It is from the roots of that commandment, this is the bottom of the first page, that because the city of the Levites were prepared for the needs of the other tribes, right? It's for the benefit of others, which of course is what we said Yerushalayim is as well. The Levites were there, it was a place of wisdom, it would inspire people to be there. And Israel would always think about it. I'm now going to the top of the next column. The cities are refuge for those charged with manslaughter, and from this also, the eyes of all of Israel were upon their cities. Right? It's very similar to Yerushalayim. People are always thinking about Yerushalayim. At the end of that second line, hence it was appropriate that these cities, that the hand of all is equal with them and the heart of all that are upon them, be of the utmost beauty and loveliness. There is glory for all of Israel with this, meaning keeping these public cities beautiful had a benefit and a positive result for everyone. By the way, this is, if you think about mitzvot, we have this concept in many of our mitzvot, hidur mitzvah. We've spoken about it. We try to make our mitzvot more beautiful, right? You try to have, I've said this before, you know, nice candlesticks or a nice etrog or a nice Shabbos table. Right? You can fulfill Shabbat. My kids always get very upset with me. When I was in graduate school, I lived by myself in a small apartment in 15th Street in New York. And I used to walk about 60 blocks to a synagogue that I really enjoyed. And then I'd come home and I was always all by myself and I was happy with it. And I had bought usually a pack of Empire hot dog. I think it was, some hot dog that were already cooked. You know, you didn't need to cook them. A bunch of this, purple cabbage. And I'd buy a bunch of newspapers and I'd have a bunch of books. And I would sit there and I would read my papers and the books. And I'd have my Shabbat meals. And I used to tell my kids, I said, oh, those are the most beautiful Shabbat meals. I loved it, you know, because I'm a little bit of a person who enjoys being by himself, and I had these, and they always get so offended. Said, "You mean it's better than our Shabbat now, where we have the whole family?" I say, "It was actually very enjoyable, you know." So they get very upset that I say that, but they actually have a halachic basis for being upset with me because you can fulfill your Shabbat very easily, right? Just don't do anything. You could sit by yourself, but that's not what Shabbat is. It's supposed to be, you know, more beautiful. So these cities are also supposed to be more beautiful, and Yerushalayim in particular was supposed to be the most beautiful of them all. The Gemara says that, you know, 10 elements of beauty came down in the world, and 9 were taken by Yerushalayim. Yes.
The tax could be so expensive.
What? Yerushalayim. Now that's a, you know what? I'm glad you mentioned that, because you're going to see something about how it's not supposed to be so expensive, at least for some people. We'll get to that. So if you go to, just to give you an idea about the concept of the beauty of Yerushalayim, if you look at the Gemara that I did below, Sukkah 51 Aleph, this is a Gemara that many of you have probably seen, but you may not have seen the continuation. The Gemara begins, Tana Rabbanan, the rabbis have taught, Mishalo Ra'ah, this is in Sukkot, Mishalo Ra'ah Simchat Beit HaShoeva, anyone who has not seen the simcha of the water drawing ceremony, lo ra'ah simcha miyamav, right? No, has not seen true joy in their days. Are you familiar with that sentence? Oh, it's a well-known sentence that during the time of Sukkot, they had these great parties where they would take the water from the pool down outside the old city walls, right? Where Ir David is now today, they would bring it up, they would pour the water on the mizbeach, on the altar, and they'd have these huge celebrations, and the Gemara goes on and tells what the celebrations were like. The rabbis would come and they would be juggling swords and fire, and there were rabbis who would do upside down push-ups, and it was like a great party. And they said, if you never saw these parties, it's as if you've never seen true joy in your life. And around Sukkot time, I think maybe even in this year, I spoke about that. What does it really mean? You've never seen true joy? If you've never seen the simcha of the Beit HaShoeva, of the drawing of the water? I mean, what about people who have weddings of their children or their own? You tell me this is the only joy that could possibly exist? And I gave an answer there. Maybe if we have time, I'll give that answer again. That's a good question. So Rav Aaron Soloveitchik asked, he says, wait a second, if we're really talking about simcha, why the focus on water, right? Simcha, wine, you know, brings simcha. Tehillim says wine gladdens the heart. Or why not take something of value, right? So, you know, today, of course, a bottle of water is pretty expensive. But it used to be that water was free, right? But olive oil is very expensive. So why not, you know, pour olive oil on the mizbeach? That'd be a sign of greater wealth. What he says is that's the whole point. Real simcha is with things that are free and things that are simple. Meaning if the only way you can have simcha in your life is by getting a brand new car, to have that expensive olive oil, or the wine, which is an external inspiration for simcha, right? You need the wine in order to have simcha. He says, if that's the only source of your simcha, that's not true simcha. Real simcha is you look at something as simple as water, and you drink it, and you're able to enjoy that. So that's how true simcha works. In other words, and he then connects it to the simachot that we have in our daily lives. He says, you know what, if you're waiting only for the wedding or the bar mitzvah or the brit milah to have joy in your life, so that's actually a chaval. You have to be able to appreciate your family on Tuesday and Wednesday, and you have to be able to appreciate your relationships all the time. And he says, if you have that simcha with the connection with a person on a day-to-day basis, so then when the wedding comes or the bris, then it's even on a higher level of simcha. But if you don't have it the first time, you won't even have it then, even at the wedding. And that's how he understands this expression. Anyone who has not seen the simcha of water has never seen true simcha in their lives, because if you can't have it on the everyday mundane level, so you can't have it even on the incredibly joyous moments as well. But I want to say something else about water in just a moment as we see the continuation of this Gemara. The continuation of the Gemara likes the expression, if you have not seen this, you've never seen that. And it uses the structure with regards to Yerushalayim. It says, if anyone has not seen Jerusalem in its glory, then you've never seen a beautiful city. Right? If you haven't been in Yerushalayim, if you haven't seen, then you don't even know what beauty is like. And so I originally brought this Gemara for that purpose, to show that the rabbis felt that Yerushalayim is so beautiful, you don't even understand what beauty is unless you've seen Yerushalayim. But then I continued with the Gemara, and I must tell you, the Gemara was a little bit surprising, so I thought to bring it, just because it's an interesting Gemara. And then at the very end, I actually realized that it is very relevant to our point. So I'm going to continue with the Gemara for a moment. It's just interesting, but we'll also see that there's a deeper point as well. So first of all, the Gemara asks, what is the temple building to which the sages refer? Remember, there was a Bayit Rishon, Bayit Sheni. Which temple, which Beit HaMikdash was truly so beautiful? Abai says that and some say it was Rav Chista, it is referring to the magnificent building of Herod, right? The temple that Herod had, sort of the Beit HaMikdash that Herod had made even more beautiful when he renovated the Bayit Sheni, the second temple. The Gemara asks, with what materials did he construct it? Rava said it was made of stones of green-gray marble and white marble. Some say it was stones of blue marble and white marble. I don't know why we need to know all these details, but we'll see in a moment. The rows of stones were set with one row slightly protruded and the other one slightly indented. They weren't straight across. There was a sort of a back and forth within it, so that the plaster would take better. Okay, it was a technical thing, but it's more than technical. Now, he thought he should put gold on top of the entire thing, right? Why not? Gold is the most expensive. Why not put gold on everything? But the sages said to him, says, no, you know what? Leave it as is with these different colors, the green and the blue and some protruding and some back. It gives the impression of looking at an ocean, of looking at the sea. And can you imagine on a hot summer day, you come to the Beit HaMikdash, and it's almost like an illusion that you see almost like water in front of you, right? Maybe this is the connection. This is, I said, that the first statement is about if you haven't seen the simcha of water, you haven't seen true joy. Maybe this is also what the rabbis are getting at, that even looking at the Beit HaMikdash is to remind us of the simcha of water. Then it goes on, and there's another statement about beautiful buildings, and this is Rabbi Yehuda. It is taught in a Baraita that Rabbi Yehuda says, "One who did not see the great synagogue of Alexandria of Egypt never saw the glory of Israel." Now, this is a surprising thing. We were talking about Israel. We were talking about Yerushalayim. And all of a sudden, Rabbi Yehuda comes along and says, let's not forget the diaspora. Now, Rabbi Yehuda is interesting. If you recall, Rabbi Yehuda, when he lived in Babylonia, was actually opposed to people making aliyah. His student, Rabbi Zeira, avoided him for several days once he decided to make aliyah, because Rabbi Yehuda was the one who says, not until God brings us all back should we return. So Rabbi Yehuda is talking about this beautiful synagogue in Alexandria. Alexandria was a city that was established by Alexander the Great, and Jews actually populated very significantly. At one point in time, there's records that say there were maybe 250,000 Jews in the city. There are five districts in the city, and two of them were dedicated exclusively to Jews, and they actually had a fairly good Jewish life there for a long period of time. They were allowed to be in their own districts and practice their own religions for some time until there was a revolt, and we'll talk about that revolt in just a little bit. He's describing, and maybe he's exaggerating a little bit, about this synagogue. He says that the structure was like a large basilica, right? You know, like the Duomo in Florence. It's these big, beautiful buildings with big domes. This seems like an exaggeration. At times, there were 600,000 men and another 600,000 men in it. It seems a little bit hard to believe that there was more people in this one building than, you know, 1.2 million people. But okay, he's obviously saying it was a big, beautiful building. There were 71 golden chairs corresponding to 71 members of the Sanhedrin. Each one of these chairs consisted of no less than 21,000 talents of gold. All right, it's a tremendous amount of gold. When we talk about Purim, and Haman needed to collect 10,000 talents of silver to have the Jews killed. So here's each chair times 70-something, right, had 21,000. So we're talking about a tremendous amount of gold. It was so big, there was a wooden platform in the center, and the gabbai would stand on there with a scarf, waving it back and forth whenever you had to say amen, because it was so big, no one knew when the chazan would finish to say amen, so he would wave it for everyone to say amen. The next paragraph. And members of the various crafts would not mingle in this synagogue. So there were people who were the carpenters, they had a corner where they would all go to, and there was the Gemara goes on to suggest there are blacksmiths over there, coppersmiths there, weavers over there, only amongst themselves. When a poor stranger entered, he would go only to the place where he was similar. So if he was a weaver, he would go to where the weavers were. And that's how business got done. Business got done in the synagogue because everyone was separated according to their particular crafts. And it was very easy to get business done in these synagogues. The next paragraph. Now there's actually a sad turn. After depicting the glory of the synagogue, the Gemara says that Abaye said, all the people who congregated in that synagogue were killed by Alexander the Great of Macedonia. The Gemara goes on and says that Alexander the Great actually asked for permission because, you know, there are some people in the Gemara who try to celebrate Alexander the Great as a deep friend of the Jews. There are examples of that. He asked for permission and then he received it because these people had been sinning. Historically, it couldn't have been Alexander the Great, because Alexander the Great founded the city, and then he left, and he never returned. He was buried there, I believe, but he died 10 years after the founding of the city. There was no way a building such as this or the population of the Jews could have grown so quickly. What was probably taking place, the Gemara doesn't speak about this, but what we know from historical records is, if you remember the they called it the War of the Diaspora Wars. The Greeks, when we fought against the Greeks in the story of Hanukkah, so there were ripple effects. And we have the Hellenized Jews lived throughout the Greek Empire and the Roman Empire eventually. And years later, under the Romans, the Emperor Trajan, there were rebellions because Jews and Greeks began to fight in different parts of the Roman Empire. And the rebellion actually began in Babylonia, and it spread, and Jews fought, and there was a big rebellion we have a record of taking place in Alexandria, where the Jews were fighting the Greeks, and the Romans stepped in, and there were great, they put down, the same way they put down the rebellion here in Israel in the year 66 to 73, the Great Revolt, but then again, in, if you remember, the Bar Kokhba Revolt in 132. So around the years 117, 119, there were these Jewish revolts, and the Romans also destroyed those revolts as well. And many people suggest this is what the Gemara is actually referring to, but they wanted Alexander to be the one because they wanted to actually show that there was something wrong in the way the Jews behaved. Okay, so they wanted to actually show, and Alexander on some level was a positive figure in our history. So it says, if you continue, it goes on, the Gemara asks, what is the reason that they were punished and killed? It is due to the fact that they violated the prohibition with regard to Egypt in the verse, you shall henceforth return no more that way. The Torah says, never return to Egypt. And they not only returned to Egypt, but they built this elaborate, beautiful synagogue and the like. And when Alexander found them, he saw that they were reading the verse in the Torah, the Lord will bring a nation against you from afar, from the end of the earth, as the vulture swoops down. And Alexander saw that at one point in time he was very successful and he was able to do a journey much faster than he had anticipated. So he said, I must be the vulture. And therefore, he decided that he had the right to slaughter everyone there. Why does Gemara bring this story, right? This tragedy, when we were just talking about the beauty of Yerushalayim. And I think part of the reason is to contrast, right? There's beauty in Yerushalayim and there's beauty outside of Yerushalayim. And on one level, they're saying the Jews acted inappropriately by leaving Israel to go build up this alternative Yerushalayim, right? You know, in more modern times, Berlin has been described as the new Yerushalayim, or New York as the new Yerushalayim. And the rabbis are critiquing that concept of, you know, you built this beautiful place, but that's, there's something wrong about it. But I'd like to go even a step further, which is to say, it's not simply physically leaving Israel, but spiritually leaving the values of Israel. And that's why the earlier story about how Herod wanted to put gold all over the Beit HaMikdash, and the rabbis stop him and say, wait a second, just looking at the blue is even more beautiful. Well, I don't know if it was more beautiful than gold or not, but when you look at the blue and look at the water, it reminds me of when we talk about the mitzvot of tzitzit, that you would look at the tchelet and it would remind you of the sea, and the sea would remind you of Avinu Shebashamayim, God in heaven. And I wonder also, perhaps that's what the rabbis are saying, leave it looking like an ocean, because that will remind us of God. That for us is beauty, is that wherever you go, you're thinking of God. That's what was taking place in Yerushalayim. In Egypt, what was taking place in these synagogues? First of all, you had all the gold. So people were celebrating the wealth, the wealth of the community, not the spirit, not the ruchnius of the community. But more than that, the synagogue became a marketplace almost, right? You had all the different businesses. You go do your business here, right? I've been to synagogues where you sit around and you know, you're talking business the entire time, right? It has nothing to do with prayer or anything along those lines. I think the rabbis are critiquing that and saying, when we talk about the beauty of Yerushalayim, it's not just physical, it's also the values. And the values are such that we need to be inspired by them in a certain way. And I think that's perhaps what they're referring to as well. And it connects me to one last point that I want to make. I'll give you one, let me just make the transition and then I'll take your question. The last reason that we're going to talk about, I think sort of supplements this idea of Yerushalayim is really all about getting us to think about God in a constant way. But it's not always easy to think about God who is intangible and ineffable, and we're here and we can't, how do we transcend that? How do we start thinking about God? So one way is to think about beauty. Like if you experience a beautiful experience, you see the blue, you think of the ocean, you think of God. I think there's another way that the rabbis are trying to get us to think about God. I think so. A shul at the end of the day is a Beit Knesset. It's a gathering point. So you're right that it need not just be a Beit Tefillah. But I get the sense, the way the description is, it seems a little bit, right? When it talks about, for example, a stranger coming in, the stranger comes in and he's not welcomed by everyone. He is only allowed to go to that place that he knows if he's a carpenter, he can go be with the carpenters. Now, on one hand, there's a positive element of that. You know, in such big, big places, it's nice to have sort of smaller communities within a community, small groups. And so there's something very positive about that. But there's also, it seems that the way you're defined by your occupation in a synagogue seems the antithesis of what a synagogue is really all about. A Beit Knesset, really, I think, is that you're not defined by your occupation, you're not defined by your wealth, you're not defined by your social status, you're defined by your relationship with God. That seems to be, it's like Shabbat is a haven from the workplace, a synagogue is a haven from the marketplace, right? You know, and so it seems that they took that haven away. And they said, we're going to continue the weekday here in Shabbat. That was my reading. It may not be there. I may be interpreting and projecting. Let me go to the next page. Oh, I'm sorry. Before we go to the next page, let me go back to the Braita, okay, on the first page. So I said that there were three or four different reasons. We spoke about beauty. We spoke about Kedusha. We spoke about that it should be accessible for Olim. Five of these 10 things that were stated, they have another reason altogether. And if you look at the Gemara, we're in the Hebrew now, the second Hebrew paragraph. The first words are Ein Habayit Chalut, right? That we saw the houses could not be, you could not put a limit on when they could be redeemed. What's the reason for this? Ein Chalut, Ein Habayit Chalut Ba Dichtiv, because it's written in Vayikra, V'kam habayit asher lo choma, letzmitut lekone oto ledoratav. This is the verse in Vayikra that basically says that you have a year to repurchase. But here it's different. Ksvar lo, and the reasoning is, lo nitlaka Yerushalayim l'shvatim, that it was not, Jerusalem was not divided amongst the shvatim. What are they referring to? So you're going to see this expression again and again appear, that Jerusalem was not divided amongst the Shvatim. For example, they didn't bring an Egel Arufa. Why did they not bring an Egel Arufa? Dechtiv, because it's written in Devarim, Ki yimetza chalel ba'adama, when you find this dead person on the ground, Asher Hashem elkecha noten lecha l'reshata, that on the land that God gave you to inherit. But Yerushalayim, lo nitchalka l'shvatim. But Yerushalayim was not divided amongst the tribes. Yerushalayim is not to be inherited by a particular tribe. It's a technical answer. Why was there no Egel Arufa? Because the Torah text, when it speaks about Egel Arufa, speaks about land that you inherited. But Yerushalayim was not inherited by anyone. It was not inherited by any tribes. The next case is the same thing. What did we say about it can't become an ir nidachat, an idolatrous city? I would have said there's a simple reason why you can't have Yerushalayim be an idolatrous city. You're supposed to destroy an idolatrous city. Could you possibly think that you're going to destroy Yerushalayim? That's not the answer the Gemara gives. Gemara says, no. When it says about an ir nidachat, it says, if there's idolaters ircha in one of your cities. But it says here, wait a second, Yerushalayim was not divided to the Shvatim, meaning Yerushalayim is not one of your cities. It's not owned by this tribe or that tribe or that tribe. It's not owned by any particular tribe. And it gives again and again this exact same thing. Why was there no leprosy on the walls? Again, there was a verse that said that leprosy would be on your houses. And the Gemara here says, it wasn't divided by the tribes, meaning no one owns their houses in Yerushalayim. Getting to the concept of wealth and the expense of the houses. Yerushalayim was not given to any of the tribes. That's the technical answer given throughout this Gemara, more than any of the other answers. Now, what does it mean, it wasn't given to any of the tribes? Now let's turn the page to the next Gemara. So this is a Gemara in Megillah that explains, I think, the concept more. There is an argument, we'll see in just a moment, about who owns Yerushalayim. Who owns it? The government. Maybe. Who owns Yerushalayim? That's going to be the question. There's a machloket about it. Okay? So the Gemara starts off. I'll be in the English. The Mishnah states, Residents of a town who sold the town square may purchase a synagogue with the proceeds. There is a concept that we are not allowed to sell things of one degree of holiness for something that is of less holiness, right? For example, I can't sell a Torah scroll in order to buy a scroll of the Book of Prophets because it's going down in holiness. I could do it the other way around. I can sell a book of prophets, take the proceeds, and then buy a Torah scroll. So the Gemara on this Mishnah has a whole series of, I'm allowed to sell a Torah scroll for something less holy, I can sell the prophets for less holy, and it goes lower and lower and lower and lower. And at the very end of that line is you could do it to help buy a town square. But you can't sell a town square to go in the opposite direction because it's considered the least holiness. But the Mishnah actually raises the interesting question. It says, wait a second, why is a town square holy at all? There's an interesting story I heard about this one Rebbe. This one Hasidic Rebbe, whenever he would go to a hospital, he would go to right outside the emergency room, and he would start praying there. Even if there was no operation going on in the operating room, in the emergency rooms. And one of his assistants said, why do you go to the operating room? No one's even there, and you start praying there. And are you even visiting people at all? And he says, listen, I am sure that outside this operating room or this emergency room, have been a lot of prayers, right? This is when people's prayers are usually most intense. When someone's on the other side, you're praying, you don't know if they're going to come out of it or not. He says, this place therefore becomes holy, and I wanted to access that holiness by praying right outside where other people have prayed with great intensity. That's the reason why a town square might be holy, according to one opinion, is because on fast days, everyone would come to the town square and they would pray there. And if everyone's praying there during a fast day, so it already has developed an element of kedusha. And therefore, if you could sell the town square, you can use it for other holy purposes. That's what the Mishnah is referring to. But we'll see that it extends this further. So residents of a town who sold the town square may purchase a synagogue with the proceeds. It has holiness and they can use it for a synagogue, which is even holier than a town square. Concerning this Mishnah, Rabba Bar Bar Chana said that Rabbi Yochanan said, this is the statement of Rabbi Menachem Bar Yossi. The rabbi said, no, the town square doesn't have any sanctity at all. Therefore, if it is sold, the residents can use the money for whatever purpose they want. So there's an argument. Some say that the town square has holiness and you can only use it for other holiness purposes. And the rabbis say, no, you can use it for whatever you want. Rabbi Menachem, who says that it's holy, what is his reason for claiming that the town square has sanctity? He says, as I just mentioned, they would go there on communal fast days, and it becomes a place of prayer, and therefore it has holiness. And the rabbis, why do they say that? They say that the town square is merely irregular. Once in a while, people show up, so it doesn't have holiness in that regard. The Mishnah states, if they sold a synagogue, they may purchase an ark. The Gemara cites a qualification to this halacha. Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmani said that Rabbi Yonatan said, they taught this only with regard to a synagogue of a village, which is considered the property of the residents of that village. Okay, you could sell a synagogue, but only if it's a village, because they own that synagogue. However, with regard to the synagogue of a city, since people come to it from the outside world, you see where I'm getting to, right? I'm going to get to Yerushalayim at some point in time. A synagogue that people come from the outside world, the residents of the city, may not sell it. They don't really own it. Even if they built it, they don't really own it because it's used by other people as well. It is considered the property of the public at large and does not belong exclusively to the residents of the city. And then there's some exceptions I left out in the Gemara. For example, there's a story of a person who lived in a city who built his own synagogue. He says, I'm allowed to sell it. I think it was a Rav who says, I can sell it, right? Another case where there are a group of craftsmen, all the bronze workers, they built their own synagogue. And they said, we can sell it because we built it. We do own it. The Gemara then says, wait, I even reject this concept. You own a synagogue by yourself in a city? I reject this. The verse states, with regards to leprosy of houses, we already saw this case of leprosy, right? That was one of the cases of Yerushalayim. That I will put the plague of leprosy in a house of the land of your possession. Right, that's the statement in Vayikra. What we learn from this is your possession. Your privately owned house can become ritually impure. But a house in Jerusalem cannot become ritually impure with leprosy, as property there belongs collectively to the Jewish people and is not privately owned. Right? Look what they just did. They said Yerushalayim is like a synagogue. Homes in Yerushalayim are not owned by you. You think you own it? It's not. Yerushalayim is owned by all of Am Yisrael. Someone says, oh, I heard this. Rabbi Yehuda says, I heard this distinction only exists by the temple alone, but not the entire city, not all of Yerushalayim. And then there's an argument that says, no, it's owned by all of Yerushalayim. And they said, what's really the essence of their argument? Rabbi Yehuda believes as follows. Who owns Yerushalayim? He says it's the tribe of Benjamin. Yerushalayim was carved out of the tribe of Benjamin, and so therefore they own it. And there's actually a midrash that says the tribe of Benjamin, as they built up the temple, were always feeling like this is our place, and they were pained that everyone else was able to use their place, and they were always looking at it, and they treated it like their own and the like. That's Rabbi Yehuda's position. The other opinion says, no, it was never given, it wasn't given to Benjamin, and then Benjamin had to give up part of it. It was never given to them at all. It was a independent element. Yerushalayim is separate from all the tribes. No tribe owned it, and so therefore, no individual can ever own Yerushalayim. They can own parts of it, but... it's not so. Here, let's continue. Let's look what that happens in the Gemara. It's an amazing Gemara that goes on. This other Tana holds that Jerusalem was not apportioned to the tribes, as it was taught in a Braita. One may not rent out his houses in Jerusalem. Think of all these people coming in through the all the Chagim. They may not rent out houses in their Jerusalem. Due to the fact that the houses do not belong to those occupying them. What you end up buying when you buy in Yerushalayim is the right of use, not the actual ownership, which actually now reminds me of the church lands. Rather, as it is, and it's true for the entire city, they're owned collectively by the entire nation. Rabbi Elazar ben Tzadok says, even beds may not be hired out in Yerushalayim. Therefore, in the case of hides, of the renter's offering, meaning some renters would come in and they would pay with hides or gifts or other things, he says, the innkeepers, meaning even hotels, if they took the payment, it's considered as if they took it by force and they have no right to demand payment. So you should take this Gemara with you next time you go to any hotel in Yerushalayim and say, I'm allowed to stay here for free. You know, I guess you have to pay for the food, but you don't have to pay for the beds. Rashi there says, Ein maskirim, that you're not allowed to rent out property in Yerushalayim. Balei batim et batehem, the owners of the houses could not rent out their houses, le'olei regem, to those who are coming up for the holidays. Ela b'chinam notnim, rather they had to give it to them for free. If you want to talk about, Yerushalayim is very expensive, but not according to the Gemara. Gemara
is different.
Yeah, the Gemara is different. That notnim lehem, you give it to them, v'nichnasim letocham, and they would come and enter for free. The Tosfot says, well, maybe there's a slight exception. Af lo hamitot, even the beds you are not allowed to rent out. So the Rav Yosef says, desfira le dekevan shekarka makom hamitot. The reason why you couldn't rent out the beds is because the land on which they were sitting, lo haya miyuchad lebalim, was not owned by the owners. Lo haya koch biyadam, and therefore they didn't have the power to rent out the beds. Nevertheless, mikol makom michamat metaltehem, but they were allowed to rent out. They took some monies because you were benefiting not from the land, you were benefiting from their beds, which are metalteling, which is not the land. So there may be way, according to the Tosfot, that if you own a property in Jerusalem, you can rent it out, but you're not renting out the land or the house, you're renting out the bed. You know, or other properties along those lines. What I think we get a sense here from Yerushalayim is that Yerushalayim is not owned by anyone. This is a continuation of what we spoke about with Shemitah. Part of the concept of Shemitah was, I don't own this land. And part of the competition that exists between people is because there's a limited amount of possessions in this world, and it's a competition over ownership. What happens with Yerushalayim and what happens with Shemitah is you recognize there's only one owner. It's God, right? All of our rights here are only the rights of usage that God grants us. So one of the things that makes Yerushalayim beautiful and makes Yerushalayim special is that it's actually constantly reminding us that God is the ultimate owner of it all. That's what these 10 statements are all about. Even the beauty we're talking about is about to constantly remind us about that. I just want to do two more things if I have the time. First of all, that's why also Yerushalayim is always a place that speaks about the rest of the world will also come and recognize the beauty of Yerushalayim. I bring the source of Avot Rebbe Natan. In the future, the nations of the kingdoms will be gathered in Jerusalem because it's only there they recognize the equality of all peoples, right? Because we are all descendants of God. We are all created in the image of God. And so long as people have the recognition that God is the creator of the world and therefore creator of other human beings, that's how you create peace in this world. Peace only comes when you recognize that God is everyone's parent, as it were. And so I think that's why it also, Yerushalayim is the center of that, because it teaches us that we don't own anything, that it's all ultimately from God. I just brought a couple of quick sources that I want to show you, and then I want to connect, if I can, the concept of Aliyah LeRegel and Karbanot. So I brought, how is Yerushalayim viewed as a legal matter in the more modern times? So who owns Yerushalayim? So when 1948, you know that the United Nations had wanted the Yerushalayim to be its own separate entity. And then, of course, the war takes place, and then there was a ceasefire between Israel and Jordan, and so the United Nations plan more or less sort of fell by the wayside, although, of course, many people today still say that it should be internationalized, and that's why they don't recognize Israel as a sovereign, not only in East Jerusalem, but even in West Jerusalem. In fact, there was never a recognition by many nations that Israel had the right to even West Jerusalem because of the United Nations partition plan that didn't include Jerusalem. And in this, in 48, many of the nations, they would not recognize Israel and West Jerusalem. They would not have meetings in Jerusalem. They would not, when the ambassadors would come, they would not come up to Jerusalem. They would not come to the president's house. They had a boycott completely. You could see how strong the boycott was. This case, the first case I bring you, the heirs of Shababo against Roger Halen. Roger Halen was the driver of the Belgium consulate in Yerushalayim, and he killed someone by manslaughter while driving. And at first, he refused to be tried, not because he had diplomatic immunity. He says that Israel doesn't control Jerusalem. This happened in West Jerusalem. So you see there, they were rejecting Israel's right to Jerusalem altogether. What the Israeli Supreme Court simply said is nonsense. It happened here, West Jerusalem. Israel's the sovereign. And actually, little by little, most countries began to recognize, not as a matter of law, but as a matter of fact, de facto, that Israel controlled West Jerusalem. I don't know if you know this. At one point in time, there were something like 18 embassies that were in Jerusalem. They had, again, they would say they're not really embassies, but their ambassador lived in Jerusalem. Because little by little, they started having meetings, and they made sense, and this all changed in 1980. In 1980, Israel passed a law, the Basic Law of Jerusalem, which basically didn't really change anything about Jerusalem, okay? Meaning in 1967, we, you know, the Six-Day War, we took over more places. The more embassies were actually here. As I said, 18 of them. And nothing really changed. Israel treated it as if we controlled, that's the second case. I don't want to go into it now to save time. But that Israel controlled and more or less had sovereignty over East and West Jerusalem together. And the nations had really kind of de facto, there were only a total of, I think, something like 38 foreign nations in Israel at all, and 18 of them were in Jerusalem. Again, they didn't do it publicly so much, they didn't want to make a big deal of it, but in 1980 we passed the law, the basic law of Yerushalayim, of being a very special place to the Jewish people. It basically encoded into law what had already came to exist. This was too much for the United Nations. The United Nations passed Resolution 478, and in that resolution it says that all the countries should leave Jerusalem's capital, and indeed that's what happened. They all, 18 of them, left, and they went to Tel Aviv. Some of them left altogether, and so the law itself that I'm referring to, I put there for you, the basic law of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the seat of the president of the state, the Knesset, the government, the Supreme Court. All those things existed already, you know, It just stated them. And the UN, it was too much that they should be stated. And it goes on there. Just want to end.
What number
478, I believe. The United States, by the way, was in the Security Council. It was a 14-0 vote. The United States, the president at the time, anyone know, 1980? Jimmy Carter. He did not veto it. He simply refused to vote. But it's interesting, Nikki Haley, when she was the U.S. representative to the United Nations, she quoted Ed Muskie, who was the Secretary of State, or representative of the UN, I can't remember, under Jimmy Carter, who says that we're not going to support this concept that foreign independent countries have to move their embassy. They should be able to choose wherever they want to choose to put their embassies. And Nikki Haley quoted Ed Muskie. Carter didn't vote for he didn't veto it, as the United States often does, but he also didn't vote for it. And Ed Muskie says, we're not going to vote for this. So Nikki Haley, when she made the recent decision of Trump, she basically quoted Jimmy Carter's administration for support of that. Just want to end with two quick points. One is the Ta'anit, the Gemara in Ta'anit, basically says that Yerushalayim is the center of the Jewish world, not just physically, but spiritually. It is the where we draw our inspiration. Jerusalem is not a physical place. It is physical. But all these physical elements are to introduce and teach us spiritual values. And therefore, that's why we need people coming to Yerushalayim as much as possible. The Shlosh Regalim, the Shemitah, the Maser. The whole nation only survives to the extent that they are constantly exposed to what takes place here in Yerushalayim. And the last point, I just wanted to connect. I began the shir by saying, this mitzvah of Aliyah L'Regel has two elements, the sacrifice and the Yerushalayim component. And we focused on the Yerushalayim. But I'd like to suggest they may not be that different. You're familiar perhaps with a statement in the Gemara that says, when it comes to Shabbat and Chag, Ein simcha bli basar v'yayin. There is no joy unless you have meat and wine. Right? That's all the times. You know, my daughter is a vegan, and I myself try to be relatively don't eat too much meat. And of course, people will say, wait a second, how can you do that? The Gemara said, ein simcha, there's no simcha unless you have basar v'yayin, meat and wine. You have to have these things. So there's many different answers of how you can say, oh, it's only if you like meat, only if you like wine. But the Gemara itself is actually very interesting. It sounds to me, when we make that statement, ein simcha bli basar v'yayin, there is no simcha unless you have meat and wine, that you have to have meat and wine, and they go together. But look at the original source of the Gemara. The Gemara is in Psachim. Tana Rebbe Yehuda ben Betera. So Rebbe Yehuda ben Betera said as follows. Omer bezman shebeit hamikdash kayam, in the time when there was a Beit HaMikdash, ein simcha ela bebasar. There was no simcha except with meat. Now, he wasn't talking about necessarily meat that you just eat. What is he saying? Shene'emar, what's his proof text? As it is written, v'zavachta shlamim v'achalta sham v'samachta lifnei Hashem Elokecha. You will rejoice in your karban, you'll bring in a karbanot, you'll rejoice in your shlamim, the sacrifices you bring, and you'll eat it, but the real rejoice is not because you're eating meat. The real rejoicing is that you've come to Yerushalayim, you've had this great celebration, you bring your karban. It's the concept of having national sovereignty. It's the concept of having the Beit HaMikdash, or spending time in Yerushalayim. The meat doesn't cause the joy. The meat is a sign of the joy because you're able to have karbanot. By the way, there's no mention of wine here. Where's the wine come from? The continuation of the statement is, v'achshav, and now, she'ein Beit HaMikdash kayam, now that we don't have a Beit HaMikdash at all, ein simcha ela b'yayin. There's no real true joy except with wine. Because as it's written, she'enemar v'yayin yisamach levav enosh, that wine gladdens the heart. In other words, we're actually talking about two different historical periods of time. In the time of the Beit HaMikdash, joy was symbolized by meat. Not because meat you're eating, but because the meat of the sacrifices of the experience of coming up to Yerushalayim. Now that we don't have a Beit HaMikdash and we're not coming up to Yerushalayim for sacrifices, so then the only simcha is wine. So when someone says, ein simcha bli basar v'yayin, the full sentence is ein simcha bli basar in the time of the Beit HaMikdash, and ein simcha bli yayin after the Beit HaMikdash. It's two different types of things. It just reminds me, I'm going to say it incorrectly, but I'll give it a shot anyway. My daughter always used to teach me, blood is thicker than water, right? What does that seem to teach us? But the blood of the covenant is thicker than water of the fetus. I think that's correct. You'll go home and check on me, and I'll give you the right answer. But the real lesson there is that it's not, we think blood is thicker than water is relationships. Right? The fact that this person is my brother, my sister, that's much stronger than not really being connected. That statement actually means the exact opposite. Blood of the covenant, meaning like a Brit Milah, or the blood of when people, you know, put blood and they make that an agreement. That, making an agreement where you have shared values, that's stronger than the biological connection of the water of the womb. In other words, it's the exact opposite of the way you're teaching it. And similarly with Ein Simcha B'li Basar V'Yayin, if you know the full expression, it's also somewhat different than what we were originally talking. It's not something about simply how I like to eat certain food. It's not an individual preference for meat. It's a national statement of sovereignty and the like. And that, of course, we learned through Yerushalayim. Have a good week.